Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
My new book, Diary of a Psychosis, is out. It's the most lively, devastating baseball bat to the throat takedown of what the public health establishment did in 2020 and beyond that you can imagine. It's my first book in 9 years, and you're going to love it. Check it out at diaryofcovid.com. And if you've already bought it, make sure also to visit diaryofcovid.com so you can claim your free bonuses, including my free companion volume, Collateral Damage, a collection of stories from real people who suffered under the restrictions. They weren't allowed to tell their stories at the time, but every one of them told me, "We just want to be heard." Check it all out at diaryofcovid.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Delighted to have with me on this episode number 2458 of The Tom Woods Show, Nick Giambruno, founder of financialunderground.com. We were just commenting that it's been quite a long time since we've had a podcast conversation together, but we are rectifying that today. Nick, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom, great to be with you.
You just comment and write about everything under the sun these days. Of course, Financial Underground is primarily financial topics, but I do correspond with you from time to time, and you are informed about everything going on around the world, financial or otherwise. But let's at least start off with some financial questions. Here, this might be kind of a curveball kind of question, but there are some real threats out there that have to do, you know, let's say, oh, I don't even want to name them because I don't want to prejudice you, but there are things that people, in other words, should legitimately be concerned about. But do you think there are also things that what we might call the liberty movement is concerned about that are kind of overblown, that they shouldn't worry about? So is there anything that we're not seeing that we should see, or that we're spending too much effort on that's not such a big deal? What do you think?
Oh, yes. Well, I say one thing that all good libertarians, good anarcho-capitalists, good liberty-loving people can all agree on is that we want to minimize coercion. That should be the foundation. Minimizing and eventually eliminating coercion. I think that everybody should be able to agree on that. So in practice, what does that mean? And to me, and look, my origin in terms of how I developed philosophically, I originally learned about a lot of these topics from Ron Paul, 2008, Doug Casey, and so forth. So, you know, we were just talking, that's been over 16 years now. And my God, the time just flies. So anyways, I think minimizing coercion is the number one thing. What causes the most coercion then is the pertinent question. Central banking, I believe, causes the most coercion, and war. So look, I think you want to look to minimize those things. I think that's where people should put their energy, their passion into those topics, just because they cause so much problems, and not necessarily get distracted with the wedge issue of the day.
Well, how about something like central bank digital currencies? There's a lot of talk about this, and there's a lot of concern about what they could amount to in practice. On the other hand, I've wondered, well, what happens if people just don't use them? I mean, you could punish people into using them, but I don't know. They're going to throw all their political capital at this. So where do you come down on it? I know you've written about it.
Well, I think they're a big act of desperation. Sure, they look scary. They are totalitarian. But never forget, remember what the first central bank digital currency was, Tom? It was introduced in Venezuela. It was the Venezuelan Petro. Did that save the Venezuelan Bolivar? No, it didn't. Not at all. More recently, they really made a very, very big push using the carrot and the stick, in other words, coercive measures and rewards in Nigeria. They used Nigeria kind of as a laboratory for their nefarious schemes. And guess what the pickup rate was? 1 out of 200, half of 1%. And that's after they outlawed any other forms of competition. They forced people to use it. And then they gave them like refunds for using it. So it really had a very low uptake. The bottom line is this: it's if the fiat currency system is not feasible, and I don't believe it is, central bank digital currencies just take that crummy system and make it crummier. More currency debasement, more control. So the good news is central bank digital currencies are programmed to self-destruct.
I hope so. So I'm glad people are talking about them because it means that this is something that has been discussed and that has almost, like, they're not even really trying to conceal what the negative consequence of it could be. So I'm glad people are awake enough to be aware of it. But I was wondering if that would be an example of something that maybe people are worried about more than they need to be?
Yes, and I would say yes and no. I'd say in theory, yes, it is a scary thing people should be concerned about. And also, I think more important than the actual CBDC itself is it reveals kind of the intentions of the people who rule us. This is what they want to corral us into something like this. Yeah, nonetheless, I don't believe it's viable. Let me just say too, communism is not viable. It was destined to self-destruct, but it took generations. Why are CBDCs different? CBDCs are different because it's very easy to opt out of CBDCs. It wasn't really easy to opt out of communism if you were born in Moscow in the 1950s. However, with CBDCs, you can just buy Bitcoin or buy gold. It's very easy to opt out. And in fact, whenever we've seen CBDCs introduced, like Nigeria, what did we see? We saw price increases, inflation, currency debasement, and increase in Bitcoin adoption. So it really is a Trojan horse, in my opinion, for Bitcoin and sound alternatives to money. So I think it's going to really blow up in the central banker's face.
You have a piece at financialunderground.com about an inflection point, 2024, there being an inflection point. And it's a reference to, because I don't want to spoil the answer, but debt levels. And that something specific has happened that portends, let's say, an unfavorable future. And I'm interested in this because for the longest time, there have been, let's say, debt and deficit hawks who have warned that the debt is getting too high. And they've warned about this year after year after year after year. And the ordinary person probably at the beginning thought, yeah, I should be concerned about this. But he's lived almost a whole human lifetime not seeing any at least obvious problems emerging as a result of all the debt. But you're suggesting or citing somebody else that perhaps we have reached a point in 2024 where it will become obvious, even to the average person, the negative effects of all this debt. So what is that?
Yeah, and yes, that's very important because I think, you know, people have heard about the debt for decades and it hasn't really amounted to a serious problem. I think the reason for this is that humans are more used to recognizing linear patterns. They're not used to recognizing exponential patterns. And I think what we're dealing with here is an exponential pattern. In short, what that means is it can look like the situation is very stable for a long time, and then all of a sudden you get huge growth, enormous growth, incomprehensible growth. And I think we're reaching that inflection point. And you don't have to take it from me. The one person I was citing was Ray Dalio. Now, I don't agree with Ray Dalio on everything, but I think he generally gets the big picture right. I might disagree with certain conclusions or certain things, but I think he generally gets the big picture right. And what he's talking about here is that the U.S. government is now, even according to its own projections, is going to be paying $1 trillion in interest costs in 2024 for the first time ever. You got to put this number into context. I always tell people, look, if you earn a dollar a second, 24/7, 365, that's about $32 million a year. Okay, so if you earned a dollar a second, 24/7, 365, how long would it take you to earn $1 billion? That takes you about 30, 31 years. Okay, so if you earned a dollar a second, 24/7, 365, how long would it take you to earn $1 trillion? The answer is about 32,000 years. So that's how big a trillion is, an enormous number. So we're paying that just on interest. And what Dalio points out is that now for what is increasingly happening and why it's compounding exponentially, not linearly, exponentially, is because the U.S. government is now borrowing money to pay interest on the debt it had already borrowed. And that has a compounding effect, not just a linear effect. And that's what we're looking at now. So I think if the interest expense is going to $1 trillion, that's already more than the Department of Defense. It's going to be more than Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid very soon. So what we're looking at here is a situation that, in my view, is finally about to get out of control.
You know, on your site, you have a lot of pieces on Bitcoin. So that makes me want to ask you, how do you feel about gold?
Oh, well, I like Bitcoin and I like gold. Look, I like to set the stage like this. In terms of money, and I view money as just a tool to store and exchange value. It's just something to send value through time and space. That's all it is. It's nothing more complicated than that. So what do we have as money in the world today? Well, we've got fiat money. And if you look at the monetary base of most fiat money in the world, it's about $100 trillion. If you look at all the gold in the world, it's about $13.5 trillion. If you look at Bitcoin, it's about $1 trillion. So that's the universe of money that we have in the world today. about it, give or take. I'm just kind of laying out an approximate big picture. So the dominant form of money by far is fiat money. I view gold and Bitcoin as far superior to fiat money. I think what's going to happen here is over the next years, and possibly by 2030, possibly around there, I think we're going to see a transition from the fiat system to something else. And then after that fiat system, because the governments are going to be debasing their currencies, in my view, like crazy, and the debt situation is a primary driver of this. So my kind of view is that I don't view fiat currency as having a much longer shelf life, maybe 5-10 years, possibly, in this ballpark. Nobody knows for sure, but I approximated that. And then what do we have after that? So I think gold and Bitcoin are the superior free market monetary alternatives to the fiat system. And then after that, I think you are necessarily going to have a competition between gold and Bitcoin on which one is going to be the best money. That's not going to come until after the fiat system has fully collapsed and demonetized. So that's kind of the long-term big picture, how I see it.
Well, on the Bitcoin front, maybe you can help resolve something in my mind. So I keep saying this to people who like Bitcoin. If you don't know Dominic Frisby over in the UK, I should introduce you to him. He's a really great guy, and he's written an awful lot about this. I asked him this. I feel like, as a guy who I'm very pro-Bitcoin, I am not somebody trying to tear it down. I have some Bitcoin, have for a long time. I'm very pleased with it. We'll just put it that way. But at the same time, when I think back to the year 2013, when a couple of people sat me down and explained to me, I was at a conference in New Hampshire, and I didn't really know anything about Bitcoin. And there were these couple of people who really liked my work who said, we need to talk to you about this because it's revolutionary and world-changing. So we had lunch, and they told me all about it. And they said, this is the future right here. And it's an amazing way you can move money and value across international borders, and it doesn't matter what anybody thinks of it, and it can all this stuff. But I feel like since that time, there's been something of a bait and switch with Bitcoin. Because I feel like a lot of the Bitcoin backers now are saying to me, in effect, they're saying, substituting for the dollar so that you could engage in day-to-day transactions like buying a cup of coffee in Bitcoin. Boy, that's hard. There are an awful lot of transactions in a modern economy, it turns out. So let's not think of Bitcoin as being like a substitute for fiat money. Let's think of it as being like a digital gold, as a store of value, and that's really what it's for. And then you say, but okay, but that's not what I was told it was for. I was told we were going to buy things with Bitcoin. Oh, yeah, there are ways you can do that, and you can buy some things with Bitcoin. But then I say, yeah, but it's very expensive to do that with these fees, and it's time-consuming. And they say, oh, no. And then they talk about the Lightning Network, which, I don't know, it seems like it barely scratches the surface of the problem. So am I just being a dope here? Or has there actually been a change in effect the mission statement of Bitcoin?
Let me put all of this into the proper context. I understand exactly what you're saying. So what the thing is there are over 2 billion consumer transactions in the world, retail transactions, small transactions, coffee and stuff like this. The Bitcoin network can handle about 500,000 transactions per day. So it can't even handle anywhere near the amount of daily, like less than 1%, much less than 1% of the daily retail transactions. Now, that it was never desirable and it was never practical to put the whole world's retail transactions on the Bitcoin network. Why? Because if you were to do that, you would need a large data center. You'd need like a PayPal. It wouldn't be decentralized. What keeps it decentralized is that it's simple and small. That means anybody's computer can run the Bitcoin software. Anybody's cell phone in the future can run the Bitcoin software. That's what keeps it decentralized and resistant to capture, resistant to centralization. Now, does that mean Bitcoin cannot scale? Absolutely not. You have to think of in terms of how monetary systems are set up. You can view the Bitcoin transactions are more akin to their base layer. They're like base layer transactions. So in the current fiat system, it's like akin to an international SWIFT money transfer. Why is that? It's because it represents final international settlement that's irreversible. It's equivalent to when you would, in the old days, when you would take like a bar of gold to one country, to another country to settle the difference. That's what a Bitcoin transaction is akin to. It's that base layer transaction. Now, all monetary systems function in layers. So for example, when you go to Starbucks, you don't pay for your cup of coffee with an international wire transfer from Switzerland. That's just ridiculous. No, you use a different layer for convenience. There's a trade-off too. So you use a different layer for convenience. You use a credit card, which settles up with a merchant bank that takes several days. So you have to think of monetary systems in terms of layers. So the Bitcoin network is akin to that base layer. And that's really the revolutionary thing here, because we've never had an innovation in base layer money in a very, very long time. So what we have here with that is the base layer. And then you build on top of that with scaling and convenience. And yes, the Lightning Network is part of that. There will be other scaling solutions that come in. However, what you really don't want to do is to compromise the decentralization of the base layer to scale it, because you're killing the thing that you're trying to scale, essentially. So what you want to do is you want to build on top of it and preserve that base layer. And that's what the Lightning Network does. There's also other networks that are being involved. And so typically a layer two network involves a counterparty. And this is where Bitcoin, I think, is better than gold, because in terms of gold, gold's biggest weakness is that gold cannot, as money, gold cannot scale without IOUs and counterparties. It just doesn't scale like as a global money. You're necessarily going to need IOUs and counterparties, banks, vaults, clearing companies, and so forth. And that's what led to centralization and actually ultimately the fiat system. Bitcoin, you can scale. Yes, you can use counterparties and IOUs with Bitcoin for convenience. However, with the Lightning Network, you can always remain in control. You don't have to give up custody. So that, I think, is the key difference, is that Bitcoin, you can scale without giving up, without centralizing, without needing IOUs. And this is a very young thing. Bitcoin is only around since 2009, and gold's been around for 5,000 years. So we are very familiar with gold. Bitcoin is a very, very novel and new thing. People are just wrapping their minds around it. Nonetheless, I find it very exciting. I find it compelling. And I think for those reasons that it has a chance. So I think it takes a very serious look. And I think that should really alleviate a lot of those concerns that you had about scaling and what it is. It's both. It's both a medium of exchange and a store of value. So I think it is both.
What do you think that, now this might sound like a dumb guy question or an obvious one, but I have my reasons. What do you think is the long-term trajectory in terms of the Bitcoin price?
If it's going to absorb all of the energy that's in the fiat system. Now, remember I said there's about 100 trillion, I'm approximating that. You could probably say there's more because you have the bond market. The bond market is just long-dated fiat currency. So conservatively, there's $100 trillion in monetary energy that's up for grabs between gold and Bitcoin. Bitcoin's about $1 trillion right now. So how much of that is going to be divvied up between gold and Bitcoin? Nobody knows. I can't tell you. Nobody can tell you.
Well, I don't mean a monetary figure, but presumably you would say that the trend is surely upward, right? Overall?
Yes. I think in the next few years, we'll see the Bitcoin market cap reach parity with the gold market cap, which is to say $13.5 trillion now. I don't know where it's going to meet, but I think we're going to see parity in the not so distant future, in the next couple of years.
All right. So the reason I ask that is, every once in a while, I get somebody saying, why can't I subscribe to one of your services in Bitcoin? And my answer always is, you can if you want to. I'll send you the information and we can do it. But what I always want to know is, why would you? If you really believe that over the long haul, this thing is going to gain in value, why wouldn't you want to hand me your depreciating dollars and keep your appreciating Bitcoin?
Oh, absolutely. That totally makes sense. You see that dynamic in other countries. For example, in Argentina, nobody wants to spend US dollars. They want to spend depreciating pesos. That doesn't make the dollar any less desirable. People love dollars here. So yes, that dynamic absolutely exists. But you know, eventually, people are going to be compelled. You're going to have to pay in Bitcoin instead of, or gold or some kind of superior money, because people are going to stop accepting the crappier money eventually. So I think that kind of resolves itself over time. But yes, people don't necessarily want to part with their Bitcoin. And it's still, in my view, we got to look at zoom out. It is still very, very, very early. This is a very, and this is something new too, because we've never had a new asset that's become a global money in 15 years or so. This is a completely new thing that just does not fit into established paradigms. So I think it's worth waiting to see how it develops. And I think it's quite exciting.
Well, let's say something for a minute then about Argentina. What did you think about the election of Javier Milei, and what are your impressions of him so far?
Yeah.
Policy-wise.
It's encouraging because I'm cautiously optimistic with him because he is by far the most free market oriented world leader ever elected. He's a self-described anarcho-capitalist, which I understand is kind of a contradiction in terms of being a head of a state. Nonetheless, he actually gets it. He, on a philosophical level, I think you could sit down with him and you would agree pretty much on everything on economics. But he has a tough road ahead. Socialism and collectivism has been very heavily ingrained in Argentina. But I think people are willing to give him a chance, even if they don't necessarily understand the philosophy. Most people I've talked to in Argentina say he's got about a year to show positive results before people will give him a year. They'll give him a chance. After that, though, I think they're going to be fed up. He's got to show results within that time frame. And one thing that he's done policy-wise that I don't think gets much attention, should get way more attention, he basically repealed legal tender laws. This is enormous. He basically said, you can use whatever, you want to use the dollar, you want to use the euro, you want to use gold, you want to use Bitcoin. I'm not going to punish you. Use whatever you want in contracts and in day-to-day commerce. Argentina still hasn't digested what that means, and the world hasn't digested what that means, but Argentina has effectively repealed legal tender laws. That's enormous.
Yeah, no kidding. And of course, we have heard, I mean, I don't know the ins and outs of the Argentinian budget. I mean, I know that there have been times in U.S. history when the U.S. budget has apparently been balanced, but they were hiding things or keeping things off the books or whatever. But it certainly sounds like he's been slashing and cutting and doing legitimate things to bring things into balance. And it's interesting because normally we associate this level of, I wouldn't say frenzied behavior, but this level of determination, we associate that with left-wing regimes. They get in, they know exactly what they want to do, they have their agenda, they're ready to implement it, they have people in all the relevant agencies ready to go and to get their marching orders. And usually, if there's anybody who's even giving lip service to the free market, that person moves very slowly, appoints very disappointing people. So this has been rather a novelty for us to observe. It's like, I'm so used to losing that I don't know how to cope with a win.
Yes, it's quite incredible because usually people who have this kind of philosophical development and understanding of free markets and human liberty, they're not very good at bringing that message to the masses on a political level. That's where Javier Milei really was different. And he didn't shy away from these views. He embraced them wholeheartedly. And you know what? People liked it. He was able to communicate. I think people who love liberty should really study how he communicated that message to Argentina, an audience that has been baked in collectivism for decades. He was able to bring that message to that audience, and he won. I think there are some lessons to be drawn from that.
Now, on a completely unrelated note, I had a recent opportunity to talk to Mikkel Thorup, and I know you know, I'm pretty sure you know him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of an expert on all kinds of international issues, whether it's relocation or real estate or a lot of other things. And I've had a lot of people ask me about second passports, and that's the kind of question that I would ask him on my show. But the impression I get is that getting a second passport is not really that easy unless, depending on the country, maybe you have a decent amount of money to invest in real estate there, or you have an ethnic background that matches that of a certain country. There are some countries that will do that for you if you are, I don't know, I think Irish or a bunch of others. So can you tell me, first of all, before we get into the merits of having one, is it really so easy to get a second passport in the first place?
No, it is not easy. You touched on all the key points. It is never simultaneously easy, fast, and legitimate. It just isn't. So yes, you can make an investment, and typically that's going to cost you at least $150,000 and up per person-ish, or maybe family, and that's the minimum, so it's not cheap. And then you can have ancestry. If you have ancestry, that is another way to do it. And the old-fashioned way to do it is to just become naturalized through residency, by living in that place. And actually, that doesn't cost much money at all. It just costs time. And actually, Argentina is one of the easiest places to do this. So if the stuff in Milei really sticks, you can get Argentine citizenship, I think, after 2 or 3 years of residency. It's quite easy. It's quite short. Argentina is a very immigrant in the good sense, friendly country. It's a country not unlike the founding of the U.S. with immigrants from Europe, all over Europe. So people should take a heart. If they're interested in this, Argentina is not a bad option to look at.
Okay, so now, Having said that, can you explain why I should care? What are the potential benefits to me of having a second passport?
I prefer that passports didn't exist, quite frankly. They are just slave cards and showing which government has ownership over you. But nonetheless, that's the practical reality that we live in today. So you might as well have more than one of them so that you aren't just claimed and aren't just the property of one government. It really dilutes the control the government has over you if you have more than one of these things. So yeah, my view is, I wish they didn't exist, but they do exist. So how do you deal with that? And what is the optimal solution here? Look, I look at this internet, and I'm quite fluent in this international diversification stuff too. The main point of that is also minimizing the ability of the state to coerce you. How do they coerce you? They take away your travel privileges. They take away your money, all sorts of things. So that's why you want to have that kind of stuff spread out in the places that it makes most sense. Then it becomes very hard for any country to really twist your arm. And that's the whole point of having a second passport. And we saw this with COVID, the COVID hysteria. You think they are absolutely going to restrict travel. That is a card I am convinced they are going to play, at least in my lifetime. I'm convinced they're going to play that card again. I want to have options where I can travel. I don't want to be pigeonholed in some place I don't want to be.
Yeah, well, I understand that. In fact, during the COVID craziness, that's when I really started to look. Now, of course, that unfortunately is the worst time to be doing it. It was when you needed it 5 months ago and now you're looking. But that was when I realized I've been to St. Lucia a couple of times. With St. Lucia, if you buy some property, it's one of those kinds of arrangements. You can get a second passport. But with St. Lucia, I felt like the only places I really want to be in St. Lucia are the resorts. I don't really want to, I don't want to live in St. Lucia. So I wasn't really sure that I would want a property there. And then meanwhile, by the way, and I know you, I don't expect you to be an expert on this, but we all know that our friend Peter Schiff moved to Puerto Rico overwhelmingly because of the tax advantages there. Now, this is not an international matter because, of course, Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory. But apparently there is a very similar arrangement in the U.S. Virgin Islands. So if I move to St. Thomas or St. Croix or St. John, I get the same tax benefits, which is at least a 90% reduction in federal income taxes, which is as long as I live there 6 months and a day. And so I started thinking about this. Okay, well, let's see. I got my last child that I have now will be out of the house, about 8.5, 9 years, 8 years maybe. So maybe I could start thinking about this after that. I'm not going to transplant the whole family to the U.S. Virgin Islands. But, as an older man, I wouldn't mind doing it. And then I found out I have to employ 10 people from the Virgin Islands in order to qualify for this. And they have to have been, you can't just pack 10 of your friends up on a plane and move them down there and do this. They have to have lived in the USVI for at least a year. So if I had 10 friends who were that dedicated to me, I could send them down there a year ahead of time, have them qualify, and then come down and hire all of them. I don't know if my enterprise will be big enough, by 8, 9 years from now, for me to be able to employ 10 people. But I would really love it to be, because when I look at that tax bill every year, it is so maddening and enraging. And I wish that there were some way around it, but I didn't know about that particular aspect. I don't know if that holds in Puerto Rico also, but I don't know, Nick, I think about this all the time. How can I get out from under this?
Yes, it's an unfortunate reality. As Americans, we are taxed as if we were residents of the U.S., no matter where we live, with those couple exceptions, with Puerto Rico and U.S. Virgin Islands. No other country does that. If you were an Italian or if you were a Canadian, once you leave Canada and Italy, they don't tax you. You're a non-resident, and that's the logical thing. So that's why Americans have to either renounce their citizenship or go to a place like Puerto Rico or the U.S. Virgin Islands. There is also a third way. There are tax breaks for American expats. It is not a total tax break, but there are things you can do. Nonetheless, I've benefited quite substantially from living an international life and being an expat and traveling and seeing different opportunities around the world. That has been tremendously beneficial in my life. And I would highly recommend people look into this. And I view the whole international diversification thing. We were talking about how, you want to do this before the bad stuff happens. Yes, you do. It's like insurance. It's like insurance for your freedom. And it's a very important thing to have, in my opinion. And it opens up opportunities for you to reduce your taxes, to see different parts of the world, to have different business opportunities, different investing opportunities. So absolutely, I think people should have an international perspective.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. And of course, you know, I've been talking a lot about Monetary Metals, which is a service for people smart enough to know they need to own some gold, but who also are ambitious enough to want to see that gold grow. And with Monetary Metals, you can earn interest on your gold paid in gold. And we have here a Monetary Metals client. David, why Monetary Metals? What value does it bring you?
Well, Tom, I started investing in gold probably about 7 or 8 years ago. And I was listening to your podcast. You had mentioned Monetary Metals. And I ran the numbers and I realized that the earnings or gains I could have had on that gold, not just in terms of earning more gold, but even looking at just the dollar value, was half of what it could have been. So by being able to earn that interest in gold on gold has allowed me to start maximizing my returns long term while also having the benefit of the safety net of earning gold, especially in such a high inflationary environment.
Well, David, that is exactly how I myself feel, which is why I also have an account at Monetary Metals. So find out more at monetary-metals.com/woods. That's monetary-metals.com/woods. Then there used to be more of a possibility of living as a nomad who you're never in any one place long enough for them to tax you. Have they cracked down on that?
Well, people still do that. That's a whole category of people called digital nomads. So people do this all over the world. Yeah. So the idea is to not spend more than 6 months or so, depends on each country. But yes, absolutely. The thing is that the way people earn money is changing. And governments haven't really, it's going to be challenging for them because now people can really earn a lot of their income in a location-independent fashion. That was not the case previously where people were tethered to brick-and-mortar stores and it was much easier to tax them, frankly. So, but how do you tax like mobile people? It's going to be challenging for them. But, and nonetheless, the international diversification, it's all about legally reducing your tax burden and legally increasing your options. So yeah, definitely worth looking into.
I suspect some places would deputize that to the IRS in the U.S. if you're an American citizen, that they would have the IRS follow up with you, let's say, if you don't respond. Because I also started thinking about that. I mean, I just got so upset thinking, what am I doing? Like, what's being done to me and to other people is just downright maddening. We know somebody, I won't reveal who it is, and nobody would know this person, but it's a younger person, like in her early 20s. Who said to my wife a couple years ago, oh, you guys probably don't pay taxes. She'd learned from Bernie Sanders that if you're at a certain level of wealth, you don't pay taxes. And I thought, are you out of your blankety blank mind? So if she thinks that, that means there's a huge number of people who actually think that wealthier Americans are not paying taxes.
It's atrocious.
Where do you even start?
Yeah, it's atrocious. And I think there's a huge amount of ignorance. And you know what this ignorance is going to lead to? I fear the U.S. is going to implement a wealth tax. It's not going to get any better. It's going to get worse, in my view. As bad as it is now, this is as good as it's going to get, frankly. So I think that's on the menu. Certainly, look at the demographics. The demographics, yeah, you might get a couple of more terms of more less blatant socialist, but I think over the long term, I think the best case for scenario for the U.S. is what happened to Argentina. It's going to get locked into a decades-long cycle of inflation and socialism, and I think you can kind of clearly see that coming.
All right, let me ask you this. You have a website, financialunderground.com, and you there are offering perspectives that are different from what I would read, let's say, on CNBC's website. So, how exactly is it that if I relied entirely on mainstream financial news, I would be misled?
Oh, where to begin? Let's talk about inflation. That, I think, is one of the most terms and concepts that confuses the average person because there's just so much gaslighting and propaganda, frankly. You know, the media is telling you inflation is a good thing. It's transitory. People think like, oh, this is so complicated. You know, I need to have a PhD in this. I'm just going to listen to what the experts on CNBC say. This is absolutely the wrong thing to do. You should never outsource your thinking to these people. So yes, inflation is one of the most misunderstood things. The average person thinks doesn't know where it comes from. Where does inflation come from? That's an interesting man on the street kind of question. Ask the average person on the street, where does inflation come from? You're going to get some weird answers. But it's very clear where it comes from. It comes from currency debasement. Who debases the currency? The government does. More specifically, the central bank does. And they don't tell you that on TV, but that's the source of it. They tell you, oh, it's supply chains or Vladimir Putin or greedy corporations. They're gaslighting you. They're lying to you. And that is a foundational thing, because know where inflation comes from and know that the media is lying to you about that. So that, is, I think, is an important one, inflation.
Do you think that there is going to come a time when the most sensible course of action you can take, if you have the means, is to get out of the U.S.?
Absolutely. What do you think the most sensible thing to do was after the Bolsheviks took over? Try and stay? No. There comes times when you have to get out of Dodge. And the U.S., I'm American. I was born. I was raised there. I have family there. It pains me to see the direction where it's going, but I have my eyes open. I see what's going on. And there might come a time where that, yes, it is best to leave. And that's exactly why you want to have that freedom insurance, that international diversification. You want to have a place to go to. You want to have a way to support yourself. You want to know how to live outside of the U.S. And that's just kind of the tragedy of the history of the world, frankly, is that so many people get stuck in circumstances beyond their control, and they just become a casualty of history. That can happen anywhere. The U.S. is no different than Russia was, or Germany was, or countless other countries were. It absolutely can and will happen anywhere. I'm not trying to be alarmist, but you should recognize what trends are playing out now and the logical conclusion of where those trends could go to and plan your life accordingly.
But I could see somebody coming back with these same trends are in other countries. So yeah, there's no real safe port in the storm here.
Well, you know, there's always a place in the world where it's relatively better. Even in World War II, the whole world wasn't on fire. And actually, you know, come back to Argentina. Where do you think all of these Europeans came from? They came as refugees and immigrants while Europe was at war in World War I and World War II, primarily. That's where a lot of them came. Latin America pretty much stayed out of previous world wars. So I think there is going to be pockets if we are going to have more conflict in this world, and I think we will. There are going to be pockets that are relative havens. Now, that is a constantly changing situation. It's constantly evolving. But nonetheless, I think having that perspective and being able to be mobile, having options is never a bad thing. And I think people should have more options. You don't have to exercise those options, but you should have them.
Well, as long as we're on this topic, what's involved in actually renouncing U.S. citizenship? Is that an easy thing to do?
They're making it harder. It used to be free. It didn't cost anything. And then they raised the fee. They continue to raise the fee. I don't know what it's at now, but it's at thousands of dollars. What else is involved? If you have a certain net worth, they hit you with an exit tax, which basically hints you as if you realized capital gains on all of your assets, even though you didn't really sell them. So they hit you with that.
Oh.
But nonetheless, I think renunciation is a quite drastic thing to do. Short of that, and short of moving to the Virgin Islands, and short of moving to Puerto Rico, there's lots of stuff you can do. So that's not your only options. You have other options besides renunciation and moving to the Caribbean. You have plenty of other options. They're a little trickier, but they are there. And I would suggest talking to an accountant and a consultant who is really well-versed in your personal situation, and they can figure a plan out for you.
Okay, well, now I'm intrigued, but I don't know how much farther I can pursue this. Chris, do you mind if I ask you, and you don't have to say, where you're located now?
I'm in Argentina right now. So I travel a lot. I spend a lot of time traveling, Latin America in particular, Argentina also, Colombia. I spend time in Colombia. I also go to Italy frequently. So yeah, I'm in Argentina at the moment. Going back to your thing, I am not sure of your personal particulars, but if you earn income online and in a location-independent fashion, you absolutely have options. So that would be worth pursuing.
Huh. Okay. I'm thinking. The wheels are turning. This conversation took a turn, Nick, that I was not expecting at all. I just wanted to talk about what's going on with Bitcoin and the economy and gold and so on and so forth.
Fun stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not interested in people's predictions about recessions and stuff like that. I mean, it just doesn't, you know, it'll happen or it won't. But so, geez, I'm sorry. Now I'm off on this. I'm trying to imagine what it would be like having lived my entire life here, having been involved in the public debate and doing my best in my humble way to persuade my fellow countrymen to do this rather than that. And then suddenly to be in a position where I'm completely disengaged from it, where it doesn't affect me and I'm not there anymore, or at least that's a possible path I could take. I could legitimately just not be there anymore. And that's just, it's so, I'm such a homebody. I love traveling, but there are things I love about America, you know, that I would miss very badly. But the idea that, like, for example, I did kind of think this way last year when I spent a little time in Spain. And I watched everybody going about their business as if the American Empire didn't exist. And I thought, what would that be like to live as if there's no American Empire? It's an interesting thought. And you do live it, apparently.
Absolutely. And no, I think that's an unsold benefit of this international diversification, as you kind of physically remove yourself from all this toxicity and stuff that's going on in the empire. And you kind of learn to focus on things in life that just matter more than what the talking heads are yelling at any given moment. So yes, that's an undersold benefit.
Okay. How long have you been doing Financial Underground?
Oh, I founded the Financial Underground a little over 2 years ago, and it's been my platform for putting out my views on economic and financial topics that I think are grossly misunderstood, that I'm just plainly interested in. I'm interested in geopolitics. I'm interested in gold. I'm interested in Bitcoin. I'm interested in other areas in the market. And it's just a platform for me to publish my ideas, frankly. And people can go there and check it out if they're interested.
So financialunderground.com is the website. Now, before I let you go, is there any issue? Now, bearing in mind that we cannot hold you responsible for anything that happens in the next 6 days, because we actually recorded this 6 days before we released it. So obviously, if there's a big bank collapse and we didn't even mention it, that is not Nick's fault. But if there's any just absolutely burning breaking news or point that you want to emphasize to people that I overlooked in my rather scattershot potpourri episode here, I'd be glad to hear it.
Well, you talked about a banking collapse. Look, I always tell people, and this is a very, very important thing, talking about misunderstood aspects of money and finance, this is a huge one. In addition to inflation, that's also a huge one. Banking is a huge one too. So I always tell people three very simple truths about banking. Number one, the money is not yours. Number two, the money is not there. And number three, the money is not money. So let me just say that real quick. Dive into those real quick. The money isn't yours. It absolutely isn't yours. It's legally the bank's. You have an IOU, not money in hand. That's a very different thing. And people should recognize that. It's not yours. So even if it was yours, the money isn't there. It's not like the bank has money, especially for you, segregated out in their vault. That's ridiculous. They practice fractional reserve banking, which is a legalized Ponzi scheme, as far as I'm concerned. So the money's not there. And the money's not money. It's fake money. It's money that people conjured out of thin air. They created out of thin air. It's not real money. It's not money that's determined on the market. It's political money. So I don't think people understand those three basic facts, basic truths about the banking system. So I would really impress people to think about that.
All right. Well, financialunderground.com is a website. I'll link to it in the description and on our show notes page. Nick, I appreciate your time. And I'm going to be paying more attention to financialunderground.com myself. As I said, I saw the piece about second passports. And I'll tell you, I've been really thinking about what my options long-term are. And as you say, they don't necessarily have to involve physical relocation, but I am not, even though I am a homebody and I have always ruled that out throughout my life, I've ruled that out. I'm going down with the ship was my attitude. Maybe not. So, but that is a conversation for over drinks sometime when we're both in Argentina or Italy or something. So thanks so much, Nick.
Absolutely, Tom. Great to be with you.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.